An experienced luthier can make one finished violin by hand in 14 days. On this episode of Once Every 2 Weeks, we take a look at the traditional construction methods and why modern fabrication technology still can't produce an instrument that sounds nearly as good as one made the old way.
Once Every 2 Weeks is a look back at music from the 90s through a modern lens and nostalgic twinge. Hosted by two guys who have been friends since high school, join us, Mark and Tom, as we examine old hits, forgotten favorites, and overlooked gems as we dive into the music that got us through all the fun of those awesomely awkward, angst-filled teenage years, one album at a time.
International Clash Day.
Ooh, that sounds very fancy. I'm glad we were recording on International Clash Day.
I mean, it's the Clash, so I don't know how fancy it actually is, but I do love me some Clash.
What's your favorite Clash song, Mark?
Straight to Hell.
Cool.
Lost in the Supermarket and Bank Robber are close seconds. How about you?
Probably Death or Glory. I do like Straight to Hell. I also like Complete Control. Lemon Calling was a classic.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
I like that none of us mentioned any of their radio hits.
I've always kind of been disappointed that it took me so long to get into them because all I ever heard was...
Rock the Casbah?
Rock the Casbah and Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Okay, Should I Stay or Should I Go is a good song, though.
And I don't think either necessarily bad, but for the amount of hype that those two exclusively got, I never felt that I needed to give them a listen, and so it was a long time before I was willing to pick anything of theirs up and listen to something other than those two tracks and realize, I love this.
London Calling was their biggest hit back in the day until one of their songs was on a commercial for jeans, right?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, Should I Stay or Should I Go was a Levi's commercial.
Okay. I feel like Rock the Casbah was probably used on something as well.
It was, Singular Wireless. Good job, Mark.
I remember back in the early days of widespread internet getting on the message boards for the Saul Goodman record label. And those message boards is where I heard a lot about upcoming indie bands at the time, like little known artists such as Modest Mouse and Death Cab for Cutie. There was one guy in the mix who, no matter where the conversation started, he would just jump in about the Clash. And his username was Joe Strummer. And then after a couple of months of this, Joe started making some really weird comments.
Yeah.
And someone finally admitted that they had hacked Joe's account. And so they started the challenge. You can probably hack Joe's account too in 3 tries or less. And most people were able to get it on 1 because his password was The Clash.
That's funny.
Good times.
I'm impressed by how deep we went on The Clash on a non-Clash, non-prepared episode.
Yes, you are correct. We are not here to talk about The Clash tonight.
If we're not talking The Clash, what are we talking today, Marcus?
Well, before we get to that, can I ask you a personal question?
Uh-oh. This is not in the script. I don't know.
If I were Eddie Vedder, would you like me any better?
Well done.
And no, we are not talking Local H either.
No, we're not. But I do like the reference.
Thank you. I thought it was appropriate.
We are talking Eddie Vedder.
We are. And speaking of Eddie Vedder, I finally got around to watching the 2017 Twin Peaks revival series.
Okay, what did you think?
I thought it felt like Twin Peaks, but oddly my main takeaway from the entire thing was that Eddie Vedder's real name isn't Eddie Vedder. It's Edward Louis Severson III. Vedder is his mother's maiden name. And that got me thinking about Pearl Jam. There's a sequence in Twin Peaks where he's playing at the Roadhouse and the announcer comes out and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, here's Edward Louis Severson III. And then the lights go up. I'm like, no, that's Eddie Vedder. What the hell are you talking about? And I looked it up and sure enough, I have had his name wrong this whole time.
Vedder's such a cool last name though.
It is. It's the third last name that he's gone by.
What was the second one?
The second one was the name of his stepdad, who pretty much raised him from infancy because his biological father left early, and he didn't know that his stepdad wasn't his biological father until his teenage years.
Whoa. What was that last name?
Mueller.
The name of his stepdad was Peter Mueller?
Yeah. So apparently in his teenage years, when he found out that Mr. Mueller wasn't his biological father, he realized that he had met his biological father once when he was younger, who had been introduced as a friend of his parents. And by that point, Junior had passed away. So their song Alive is pretty much autobiographical.
What you thought was your daddy was nothing but a
While you were sitting home alone at age 15, your real daddy was dying. Sorry you didn't see him, but I'm glad we talked. That part?
Yep. There's two other songs in the Pearl Jam catalog that touch on those subjects as well and create a whole trilogy inspired by childhood trauma.
That's why I always liked that song so much.
Could you relate to it?
I didn't know my father for the longest time until I was 14. And yes, that is traumatic. And I only saw him a handful of times. One time when you and I were teaching my eldest half-brother very, very bad dating advice.
We were giving him solid life lessons. And I was with you a second time when we saw him working security at the Woodlands.
We did. We saw him working at the Cynthia Woods Mitchell Pavilion.
Hanging out next to the beer tent.
Yep.
Well, since we're getting personal, have you ever seen Pearl Jam?
No, I have never seen Pearl Jam live. I have seen several of their concert videos, but I have never seen them live.
That makes me sad.
Me too. I've seen some of their memorabilia at the Seattle Pop Culture Museum. There's some cool Pearl Jam stuff alongside the Nirvana stuff.
Nice.
But I believe you saw them.
I got my very first credit card just so I could get tickets to see Pearl Jam.
And that was during the same time period of music that we cover for this podcast.
It was. I saw them October 30th of 2000 in Sacramento. I had just moved out there and had started going to community college. And like the second week of school, there was a table set up in the cafeteria where if you signed up for a credit card, you could get a little door hanging basketball hoop and ball. And we needed one of those for the newsroom. So I put in an application for the card, got the basketball and forgot about it. But then months later, I realized that Pearl Jam was in town the next night and I had no money. And I was looking through the mail that day and there was the credit card that was like, hey, you've been approved. Just call this number to authorize it. And so I was like, cool, I can get tickets to Pearl Jam. So I got a ticket and misgauged what the weather in Sacramento that time of year would be and would have frozen to death if it wasn't for the merch table having both long sleeve shirts and sweatshirts. So I ended up with one of each and layered and survived the night. And turns out that it was one of the shows that they recorded live and put on CD. And going into the show, I was young and at the age where I was into trying new things. And I was like, I have never lost my voice. So let's see if I can just yell and cheer and be loud enough that I lose my voice at the show.
Did you do it?
I did not lose my voice. All those years of drama vocal exercises apparently paid off. But on that recording, when they released it, I bought it. And I can clearly hear myself between songs in the crowd just yelling like an idiot. And so while I didn't lose my voice, the consolation is I can claim that I did provide backing vocals on a Pearl Jam album. But additional fun fact on that show is Lifehouse was the opener. And it was a couple of days before their very first single dropped.
Hanging by a Moment, right? Was that their first one?
It was. Nobody knew who they were, and they were so small they didn't even get to share the main stage with Pearl Jam. They had set up a side stage over by the concession area, and Lifehouse was playing there. And I just happened to be up and walking around, and I was like, hey, these guys sound good. I'll go watch them. And then afterwards, they passed out CD singles, and I put it in my CD player on my drive home, and Hanging by the Moment, being the lead single, was on there. And it made me sad, because I thought they were really good, but I realized they were never going to be huge because that song was going to blow them up with teenage girls and they would never be able to be taken seriously as a rock band after that.
What happened to them?
That song was released and they became huge with teenage girls and they were never actually able to be taken seriously as a rock band.
Bummer, dude.
Yeah. But Pearl Jam was amazing and they were a successful rock band and have continued to be so for a bajillion years.
It's a really cool story. I'm glad you got to see Pearl Jam. Tonight, we are covering one of the grunge big four, Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam came out of the scene around the same time as bands like Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, and Nirvana. Of the big four, they're the only ones to make it out of the 90s intact and the only to still be around today. They're the only ones without a death in the band too, right? They're the only ones that are all still alive is what I'm saying.
Yes, they are also the only band that still has all the members still alive.
Yes! Yes, Mark! I feel it's important here that I mention I have made Christine hate Pearl Jam.
Really?
It's because I always sing in an Eddie Vedder voice and she hates it so much. Yeah, I'm still alive.
Interesting.
Anyway.
All of that is to say that Pearl Jam has been a big enough band for long enough that we don't feel the need to give an extensive history of the band or its members.
No.
But as a public service for those of you who have just woken up for a coma for the first time since the late 80s, we will give you the bullet points.
When everybody thinks of Pearl Jam, they do think of Eddie Vedder because he has such a big personality.
He is pretty much Bono in flannel instead of medicinal sunglasses.
Guitarist Stone Gossard and bassist Jeff Ament. They were members of another band called Green River, not Moon River. Green River,
like The Killer,
is often cited by critics, fans, and rock historians as the band that invented grunge, but they broke up because Stone and Jeff rocked harder than their frontman in the band wanted to rock. So they started another band together called Mother Love Bone, and a few days before their debut album was supposed to drop and change the rock world, their new frontman overdosed and died.
He did. So to work through the grief, Stone reconnected with an old friend from junior high who also played guitar, and they started jamming. That friend is Mike McCready, and that jamming turned serious enough that Stone reached out to Jeff, and they had a new band on their hands. Almost.
While this was happening up in Seattle, down the coast in Southern California, Eddie Vedder was playing music in a band who started out listing Duran Duran as their biggest influence. His friend Jack passes Eddie a demo tape of the new Seattle band called Mookie Blaylock, and they were looking for a singer, so Eddie writes some words, records some vocals, and sends the demo back to Mike, Jeff, and Stone, who dig his sound.
They dug it enough that Eddie moved up the coast and joins the band, who, in addition to eating up and spitting out drummers, are working on a side project with a couple of the guys from Soundgarden, because Soundgarden frontman Chris Cornell had been roommates with the recently departed Mother Love Bone frontman Andrew Wood. Eddie gets invited to do some backing vocals with that band, which was Temple of the Dog, and along the way, to avoid legal issues with Mookie Blaylock, the Seattle Supersonics basketball player, Mookie Blaylock the band changed their name to Pearl Jam.
Pearl Jam goes through a few more drummers. They released a stellar debut. They made a great music video, and they generally blew up huge.
Huge.
Huge. After that debut album, which I will say is one of my top favorite albums of all times, 10, they recorded another great album. Their stellar sophomore album was called Versus. And then they kind of split the fan base with their third album, Vitalogy, which begins to step away from grunge and gets into more of an artsy, weird place.
Yep.
During the making of Vitalogy, they once again have drummer issues, and they bring in Eddie's old pal Jack to be drummer of Pearl Jam.
In all of my research, I think the most interesting thing I found was Jack, because he's the one piece of the Pearl Jam puzzle who I didn't really know anything about when I started researching this episode. And I found him not only interesting, but I think his contributions to the band are much larger than simply recording one track for Vitalogy and then sticking around for the next couple of records. And now we're going to tell you why.
Dun dun dun. Jack Irons was born and raised in LA. He got a drum set and started taking lessons at a young age. And in junior high, he became friends with a classmate named Hillel Slovak. And they started a band with some other kids, but Slovak didn't think their bass player was good enough. So he taught another classmate friend of theirs to play bass and kicked out the original bassist.
At a point, that friend turned bassist started going by the mononym of Flea. And at a point, Flea put together a side project with Irons and Slovak for what was supposed to be a one-time performance under the name of Tony Flo and the Miraculous Majestic Masters of Mayhem.
And Tony Flo was another friend that they had, all made in high school, who was this guy named Anthony Kiedis. That one-time one-off was received so well, they kept it going and changed the name to Red Hot Chili Peppers, who in turn did so well, they quickly got a label offer. However, What Is This, which was the main band that Slovak and Irons had been in before Flea approached them about doing Tony Flo, had signed their own label deal a couple weeks before the Chili Pepper deal came, so they quit Flea's little successful side hustle. What Is This recorded a couple of EPs and a single album before breaking up, and both Irons and Slovak eventually found their way back into the Chili Peppers. So despite having recorded the band's very first demo, Jack Irons didn't play drums on Red Hot Chili Peppers album until their third, The Uplift Mofo Party Plan, which was released the year before Hillel Slovak died of a heroin overdose, which shattered Jack, and he again left the band to receive psychiatric treatment. It's a lot to go through.
Yeah, and all at a very young age. After that treatment, he spent a stint as a member of Joe Strummer's backing band to bring it back to The Clash because they're the only band that matters. However, The Clash were done and Joe Strummer had a different band by this point. I don't want anyone thinking that Jack Irons drummed in The Clash.
No, I'm glad you clarified that.
After that, he then started his own new band called 11. Around that same time, Stone and Jeff sent him a demo tape and an invitation to join Mookie Blaylock, which he declined since he had just started his Stranger Things tribute group. But Jack knew they were also looking for a vocalist and thought that his buddy Eddie would be a good fit. Then once Eddie got settled and the Pearl Jam ball was set to start rolling, Jack called his good old pals in Red Hot Chili Peppers, put in a word, and talked them into taking Vedder and his new group out to open on the Red Hot Chili Peppers Blood Sugar Sex Magik tour.
During the recording of 11's third album, Iron was once again invited to join Pearl Jam, and this time he took it. 11 brought in Soundgarden drummer Matt Cameron to take over for Jack, and Matt finished the album with 11, and Jack helped Pearl Jam finish their third album, Vitalogy, which on its own is interesting since Jack would stick around with Pearl Jam to record their next two albums, No Code and the focus of this episode, Yield, which in the process of touring in support of Yield, Irons would leave Pearl Jam to focus on his mental health, and Pearl Jam brought in Soundgarden drummer Matt Cameron, who has been Pearl Jam's drummer ever since.
Yes, he has. I know on prior episodes, we've talked about how when it comes to playing in bands in local scenes, it can get pretty incestuous.
Good night.
And I think what I really like about Jack's story is how it's pretty much the same thing at play, but on a larger scale that reflects the talent of all the players. It's also just a good old testament to the power of networking. You never know how little things like jamming with junior high friends will create the Red Hot Chili Peppers, or something as simple as passing a demo tape to a dude in another band you occasionally play basketball with will result in a thing like Pearl Jam.
It is, but it also shows when we talk about grunge, it really was a unique construct that came out of Seattle. All of these bands and these people going back and forth are all in Seattle, and the biggest influences were from Seattle. Now, I have a beef to pick with Seattle.
Okay.
I've been to Seattle multiple times, and I just have this impression of it being gloomy, rainy, and miserable, which is why so many of these like middle-class white kids were angry in the 90s. But every time I'm there, it's beautiful weather, and I'm like, I would love to live here.
I've been through Seattle on tour a handful of times, and it has never once rained when I've been in Seattle. I always feel gypped.
Don't you, though? Like, it's, why did I even come to Seattle if I don't get to experience the rain?
Yep.
I guess it's like the crow says, it can't rain all the time.
Well done.
Anyway, to bring it back to Pearl Jam, we mentioned earlier that they got huge following their debut album, and most people know that it made them big enough that they felt they were in a position to do things like take on Ticketmaster. Less common knowledge is the fact that the level of rapid success scared them all, and they hated it because it brought a lot of pressure that they didn't want. All the jumping through hoops of media interviews and making music videos were the kinds of things that the band had no interest in.
That's true, and maybe it's because I didn't have cable growing up, so I didn't watch MTV, but I never knew, or I guess I never thought about it, so I didn't realize that after 10, the band stopped making music videos.
Hmm.
Yeah, at least up until this album.
But in the 90s, making music videos and doing interviews were the kind of things that would help you sell records. So how did Pearl Jam deal with that?
They were perfectly willing to accept lower sales numbers in exchange for their own peace of mind. But as they got older and put out more albums, and by the time they got to the point where it was time to make Yield, just with the music they were making, I feel like their fan base would have been in decline regardless.
Lucky for them, in decline meant that they only had a few million fans on the planet, so realistically, they were going to be okay. But they had also, at that point, years of working as a band and setting goals and figuring out how to stay sane while doing the work. So going into the process of deciding to record the next album that would become Yield, Eddie was more comfortable with the rest of the band to ask for help, and they decided that they would write this one a little different.
In an interview with MTV, bassist Jeff said, "I think the last couple records, Eddie has really been at the helm of those. At the end of the last record, he said, you know, this was really a lot of work for me, and next time it would be great if I didn't have to work so hard on the arrangements, and if people came in with more complete ideas, and even more complete songs. That would really help me out a lot, and I think everybody took that to heart."
As we said, that album would be Yield, and it was a turning point for the band in being more of a cohesive and whole band product and not just Eddie and the Jams. Jeff and Stone both brought fairly complete songs with words and music to the table, and to their credit, those songs fit in nicely alongside the ones that Eddie had written himself.
Something else I found interesting about this approach is that there are a handful of interviews with all the other guys in the band talking about how this approach, in a way, re-energized the band, and how since Eddie felt less overwhelmed, he was more fun and willing to work on everyone else's songs before his own, and they all got to know each other better, which seems like an odd thing for a band at this level, who were working on their fifth album together.
Good for them. That is crazy. When it came time to record the new songs, they once again worked with Brendan O'Brien. And at this point, he had produced every Pearl Jam album, but this would be his last album with the band until Backspacer, which wouldn't come out for another 11 years in 2009.
In reference to working with O'Brien, Jeff said in an interview with Billboard, he brings a brutally honest approach to what he thinks is working and what isn't, and it really moves things along. We don't get weighted down with ideas that maybe aren't even that good. He's one of the few people outside of the band that we trust with our music.
Of that time in the studio when they were working on Yield, Jack said, "We didn't put any time limit on it. It was like, when the record's done, we'll call it a record. We took our time to come out with the ideal sounds and feels for every song so that each had its own identity. And we would cut a track and go back and listen to it and openly discuss it. If one of us thought something could be done differently or better, we'd just try it again. That was a privilege. And doing a record like that felt like a luxury rather than having to rush to get something done."
For this album, the genesis of the themes came from a novel called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, in which the title character, who was pretty much Grodd, a gorilla who can communicate telepathically, expounds on the problems of human civilization. It was a novel everyone in the band passed around and read while writing the album, and they all seemed to connect with some of the ideas of yielding to nature. But as the work progressed, in a way, the idea of the album shifted further into finding ways to more generally yield to life, the universe, and everything.
A quote from Mike McCready to the website Given to Whale, which is a Mike McCready fan site, says, quote, "I think the title Yield has to do with maybe being more comfortable within ourselves with this band. Whereas the earlier records were like verses, we were kind of reacting to the storm of press and craziness that was happening. Now we're all a little bit older and a little more relaxed and maybe just kind of yielding to those anxieties and not trying to fight it so much. That's what it kind of feels to me. Yielding, letting something else happen and going with it."
And at the end of the recording process, everyone was in such a good space with it all that Eddie was even willing and maybe even eager to give interviews for it. And talking about all of that in one interview, he said, "We're not the same people we were 5 years ago. There's cool and cynical, which to me is dull and boring. It's a perfect way to get youth, you know, being sarcastic and saying everything sucks. At this point, I have to fake it to do that. I'm a little more positive about the whole trip now. We've had time to count some blessings. I'm in a tremendous position, being in a band and making music. I'd be an idiot not to enjoy the opportunity."
One thing we didn't have on the Buffalo Tom episode that we usually talk about is the cover art.
Well, that's because it's not nearly iconic as some of the others that we do, like this one.
Right, this one is iconic. It's a photograph of a Yield traffic sign in an empty highway through a stretch of the Montana landscape that Jeff was familiar with since he was on the way to his home.
Fun fact, Jeff was raised in a small town in Montana where his father was the barber, the school bus driver, and the mayor.
The band liked the idea of juxtapositioning the traffic sign in a place where there is seemingly nothing to yield to. So the cover where the sign is, or rather where it should be, is cut out. And when you open the flap, it's actually another picture of another Yield sign. The accompanying book is full of other photos, all of which have the triangular Yield sign shape hidden somewhere in the images. It was nominated for a Grammy for the best album packaging, but it did not win. Somehow it lost out to Madonna's Ray of Light.
WTF, mate.
I did go look up Ray of Light, and it's not impressive.
No, I looked it up as well, and it's just a picture of Madonna. That apparently, the story is that they spent like 8 hours shooting pictures, and the photographer wasn't convinced that they had it, and Madonna was ready to give up, but the photographer made her stick around longer, and then finally later got a shot that they thought was good enough. So that story alone makes me like, well, then either you didn't have a clear concept or someone, if not both parties, were doing something drastically wrong. At that point, Madonna should know how to strike a pose and the photographer should know how to get what they want in 8 hours or less. Anyway, Yield was released February 3rd, 1998. And because they had a declining fan base, it took 11 weeks to go platinum. It peaked at number 2 on the Billboard 200, making it the first Pearl Jam album to not reach number 1 thanks to the Titanic soundtrack, which makes me even more glad now that I have never seen that movie. but it did reach number one in Australia, New Zealand, and Norway. In addition to the US, it hit number two in Canada, Japan, Italy, and Portugal. It was also fairly well received by music journalists.
I like the way you can vocalize air quotes. That's a good talent. In the LA Times review of Yield before the album dropped, they addressed that issue we touched on briefly of Pearl Jam's declining popularity, which of course is only tracked by sales numbers. And on that issue, they wrote, "The irony is that Pearl Jam's music, both in the passion of the music and in the range of themes, has advanced during that time in ways that are equally dramatic. In its moment of truth, Pearl Jam didn't blink. Vedder's gritty, convincing vocals, long one of the band's strong points, continue to express a variety of emotions with character and authority. We won't know until the album hits the stores whether Yield will reverse Pearl Jam's commercial fortunes, but the album's contents answer the most important questions. The band's music continues to grow in all the important ways." And I want to chime in here and say that has continued, and I think that's been a big thing that's made me stay connected to Pearl Jam so much. Their album they released back in 2013, Lightning Bolt, had the song Sirens on it, which is one of my favorite songs of all time. And I don't know if it's my first or second, it goes back and forth between Black and Sirens for my favorite Pearl Jam song.
EW gave Yield a B in a review that stated, "It would have been a tragicomic coda to the sad saga of 90s guitar rock had Pearl Jam decided to dabble in electronica or add dance beats to Yield." Thankfully, they've resisted such loony impulses, turning in an intermittently affecting album that veers towards fiery garage rock and rootsy acoustic-based ruminations. Perhaps mindful of their position as the last alt-rock ambassadors with any degree of clout, they've come up with the most cohesive album since their 1991 debut, 10.
In a rare moment of clarity for Pitchfork, and Mark, I hope you're sitting down, they managed to somehow offer an interesting insight into the state that music was in at that time when they said, "One of the pressures Yield will have to face is that people expect it to offer some clue about where American rock is headed. With genre fusions rising in popularity, many have proclaimed that traditional rock and roll is dead and now look to Pearl Jam to provide something more enthralling than Britpop, trip hop, and bubblegum bebop that's been commercialized in recent months."
Of course, they did follow that up with dedicating a whole paragraph into taking pot shots at Eddie Vedder's ego, which really kind of seems odd, although still on brand for Pitchfork, in a review that they were willing to give an 8.5.
Pitchfork go on to actually positively state, quote, "This disc is one that requires repeated listening to get the gist of what the band is trying to communicate. After being digested and dissected, Yield becomes perhaps the most lyrically powerful album Pearl Jam has ever produced."
And then they incorrectly give Vedder credit for writing all the songs so they can take a few more pot shots at him before reeling it back to close the review out by saying,
"In short, its songs seem more honest than in previous efforts, but more importantly, Yield proves that Pearl Jam, and even rock music, is still alive and kicking. What remains to be seen is whether fans can deal with the band's new level of maturity."
Guitar World is one of the rare few who bothered to actually look at the album credits. They said, "What's amazing is that you'd never know that the creative furniture has been rearranged if you didn't check the liner notes. The fact is, Pearl Jam's latest creative evolution is their most profound to date. With Yield, they have taken a quantum leap towards becoming a true band of equals. Vedder and Gossard, who dominated previous albums, took a step back, allowing the other band members to fill the void. In doing so, they've opened up the creative process in ways few other established bands would ever dream of." And that's a pretty solid review. However, I think my favorite that I came across was from NME, and it's a write-up that actually tore the record apart with British sensibilities that, despite their own obvious distaste for the album and American rock, still made for an enjoyable read with moments like, "Yield could very well nearly be described as a loud pop album, albeit one made by strikingly famous personalities. After years of pseudo-grunge grinding and or cosmic hippie blatherings, often delivered with all the social skills of a paranoid skunk, Pearl Jam have finally ended up here. And despite those strong opinions, they still managed to give the album a 7 out of 10.
Let's close out our reviews on a high note, and let's turn to MTV, which kids today, I think we've mentioned this before. MTV actually stands for Music Television, and it used to be a channel where you would go to watch music videos, hear music news, instead of being like 11 and pregnant or whatever dumb shows they have now. You would even turn on MTV at home to just listen to music. I know. It was great. But MTV said, "It's a stunning work from a group clearly at the top of its game. With Yield, Pearl Jam manages the difficult feat of delivering an album that both echoes the sound that made us fans in the first place, yet continues the group's musical evolution."
And I'll agree with parts of that and a handful of the others throughout the album. One of the things that we talk about on some of these songs is tonally, this does feel like a step back to the tones they used on their first couple of albums. It's still an album that's all over the place, but I think that's really the reason that all these reviews make those notes more than anything else. Now, Pearl Jam as a band, in addition to everything else they've done over the years, they've also built an incredibly comprehensive website that's full of statistics that do things like track how many times they've played each of their songs live, which I found interesting. So as we go through, one thing that we've added for this is we'll occasionally be talking about some of these numbers.
Want to start with the most obvious place, which is song one, Brain of Jay, which has been played live 131 times. Eddie wrote the words and McCready wrote the music.
To me, that number feels low for a song that's been in their catalog for so long, because this is one of the ones on the album that does really rock.
It's a rock song.
And after a false start, Brain of Jay opens the album with a blistering rock track that, in addition to a blazing lead guitar, features the second guitar going off and creating some great textures thanks to generous use of feedback and a wah pedal. Or maybe it's a whammy bar. I don't know. I just know I love it.
It's interesting that that's what stuck out to you, because after that false start, when the guitars start, the song really kicks in when I hear that, I don't know what word to use, very loud, very powerful drum.
Mm-hmm. Jack made a great contribution.
It was. The whole song went well together and feels like Pearl Jam to me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the reviews said that the album was a return to form for the band, and right off the bat with this one, you can see why. From the urgency and fury of the delivery to the tone of the guitars themselves and the drums, it's all on point for a classic, young, loud Pearl Jam.
Fun fact, the opening line, "Who's got the brain of JFK?" is a legitimate question, since the former president's brain, which was removed as part of the autopsy process following his assassination, was preserved only to later disappear from the National Archives, and it is still missing.
I can safely say I do not have it.
I wish I did. That would make for a great random thing sitting on a shelf.
The words for this song aren't what really got me. I don't pay a lot of attention. It's just the song just rocks hard.
Yeah, and the words beyond that opener I don't necessarily care so much about, but I do just like the opening, since I don't think that I'm fanatical about it, but when it comes to the JFK assassination conspiracies, I do consider myself a member of the faithful.
Song two, Faithful, with 102 plays live, which when I think of this song as playing 102 times and the brain of Jay playing only 131, I see what you mean about the number of times that the first song was played seeming out of sync.
Yeah, they don't give it enough credit live.
Again, the words are from Vedder, the music from McCready, and the two make a song baby together.
Although, just to make sure you don't think they're reverting back to full-on grunge mode, Faithful starts subdued with some light drums and easy guitar strumming, and Eddie doesn't even start yelling until nearly a full minute in, when the rest of the band pick up the rock without necessarily turning up the pace of the track.
Yeah, he's just singing. The structure of this song is one that's interesting, because the two verses of the track act more like bookends. The first verse ends, and it's that transition into what seems like it would be the chorus, where they all just get louder. But then they get into a serious thing, because they jam the chorus out for 2.5 minutes, before going back to the more subdued parts, and finally give us a second verse just in time for the song to end.
Yeah, like you said, the main bulk of the song for the duration of it is just jamming that chorus out, which in no way is a bad thing. It's just different.
It is.
Track three.
No Way.
Which has not been played live since October 20th of 2014 in Milwaukee.
And between 1997 and 2014, it was only played 12 times.
Yep.
We mentioned earlier how the songs that Eddie didn't write jive nicely with the ones that he did write. And this is one of those prime examples. Since the words and music were written by Stone, it's kind of funny because a lot of the reviews examine the lyrical content of this song by holding them against the context of Eddie Vedder's ego and question his state of mind, but they don't actually acknowledge that he didn't write this song.
Right, like that Pitchfork review that we read, they're all just attacking Eddie, but in an interview, Eddie did say how he enjoyed this one because he could then just kind of shift the blame to Stone. But for all the attention this one got in the press, it is odd because, like you said, they've only played it 12 times, which is a damn shame because this song is a Stone Cold groove.
Is that because Stone wrote it?
No pun intended. But seriously, the drums hit in a way on this that's very reminiscent of how the beat hits on Zeppelin's When the Levee Breaks.
Ooh, nice connection.
And yeah, I really just like the way that this song grooves.
I do too.
The song jams.
This song does slap. And I say it slaps because you can really hear the bass. The bass is a first class citizen in this song. Everything about this song is great. And I do like the lyrics. I'm kind of bummed they don't play it.
Yeah.
This is the first one where the lyrics actually stood out to me as having a meaning or like being an important part of the song. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. As far as like having some depth to them.
They do have depth. And there's this questioning of who I am. What's my purpose?
And to go along with that, Eddie does a wonderful job, despite them not being his words, of really sinking his teeth into the delivery.
Absolutely.
And even the flow of his own vocal parts. It's like every time I read these, I can't not read them in the cadence of his delivery.
Yep.
Just looking at the part, to all the oceans of my platitudes, longitudes, latitudes, it's so absurd.
I like this song.
Same.
It just makes me connect with Eddie in a way that makes me feel like he's given to fly.
Track 4, Given to Fly.
This one's not one that I don't think anybody's ever heard of.
They do give this one love, and they have played it 501 times live.
Well, I think that's because it was their first single off of the album.
It was.
It hit number 1 on the Billboard Mainstream Rocks track chart, number 3 on the Billboard Modern Rock track chart, and number 21 on the Billboard Hot 100, as well as hitting in the top 10 in Finland, Norway, and Spain. And it peaked at number 13 on the Australian singles chart, reached the top 20 in the UK and the top 30 in Canada on both their top singles and alternative top 30s chart. And we're back to our dynamic duo of Vedder and MacReady doing words and music respectively.
And carrying over the idea of Zeppelin references from the previous track, there was a sloppy review from EW that called Given to Fly a thinly veiled rewrite of Led Zeppelin's Going to California. And even after reading that and listening to the two songs next to each other, I still don't hear it. Although MacReady himself in an interview has been willing to say that there could be some subconscious ripoff happening since Zeppelin are amazing and in his regular listening rotation. Regardless, as a fun follow-up to all of that, in 2005 at a Hurricane Katrina benefit concert, when Pearl Jam played Given to Fly, they transitioned from the song into Going to California, and at that point they were joined on stage by Robert Plant.
Whoa.
So, whether I hear it or not, apparently they got some mileage out of it.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Given to Fly is a bit slower start. It's got some nice light and airy guitar trickling, and then the drums then come in on a solid tom, focused rhythm, but are kind of low in the mix and sit nicely under everything to help build the mood once the pace starts to pick up as the song transitions out of the first verse and into the first chorus.
And it's that build, the rise and fall and the climax of it all musically, that make this not just one of the standout tracks of the album, but also, in my opinion, one of the best tracks in the Pearl Jam catalog.
Like the whole catalog?
Yep.
Okay, nice. In an interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer, which we all know is the bastion of resources for music reviews.
Who would be a better authority on Seattle grunge rock?
Eddie explained the track by saying, I imagine the song as a 20-page cardboard children's book with a line on each page and a picture to go with it. It's a fable, that's all. The music almost gives you that feeling of flight. And I really love singing the part at the end, which is all about rising above anybody's comments and about what you do and still giving your love away. You know, not becoming bitter and reclusive, not condemning the whole world because of the actions of a few. You can tell he loves singing that high-flying part at the end.
Yeah, it's a strong song.
Yep.
All around, musically, vocally, lyrically.
Yep.
It's the kind of song that I'm sure plenty of other artists would put on a wish list of songs they wish they had written.
Song 5, Wish List, played 252 times. This is our first song that we've had that the music and the words are written by Eddie Vedder.
This was the second single from the album. It's a bit more on the quiet side and maybe more feel good than most Pearl Jam tracks. And for those reasons, it seems to me like an odd choice for being a single when the album has so much more to offer. But what do I know? Because the song still reached number 6 on both the mainstream rock and modern rock track charts, as well as peaking at number 47 on the Billboard Hot 100, as well as placing number 13 on the year-end alternative top 50 in Canada.
It just feels a bit out of place for me in the album.
The prior track, Given to Fly, doesn't necessarily hit super hard, but it's such an up and it's such a good song that I think it is kind of hard to follow with anything.
Maybe that's it. I don't know.
And I think maybe that's why this one never resonated with me, despite it being a successful single. It always just seemed like, well, Given to Fly is so good, let's just throw something in there that's going to let people, you know, just recover from that.
think I don't like this one because to me it just sounds really whiny. Eddie just sounds really, really...
His vocal delivery?
Yeah.
He did explain the lyrics in an interview saying that it was a stream of consciousness exercise. It was probably 8 minutes long. I listened to the tape and picked out the better wishes. And when it was released as a single on CD, it was accompanied by the B-side track You, just the letter, not the extended word, as well as a live version of Brain of Jay that was taken from a show in Australia that may now be more familiar to people, since last year the band released that entire Australian show as a special Record Store Day album entitled Give Way, since Down Under, that's apparently what they put on signs instead of the word yield.
Those wacky Aussies. The next song is Pilot, song 6, which only has 34 plays. And this one I just don't like. I'll be honest, I do not like anything about this song, which I feel bad. Sorry, Jeff Ament, who wrote the words and lyrics to this one. But I think we see why there's such a strong bass presence here. It kind of starts off soft and picks up. And Mark described it as a little funky rock bit on its chorus, but I think it's just utter garbage.
I don't think it's entirely bad.
Oh, it is. It's bad. Nope. I'm going to disagree with you. I do not like this song.
Spoken like somebody who's never listened to Stone Gossard's debut solo album. I don't think it's great or even good. And it's very much an oddity in the Pearl Jam catalog. But as a song on its own merits, I don't think it's entirely bad. There's aspects about it. I do really enjoy Eddie's delivery on some of these lines. And maybe that's just because it's classic Eddie Vedder saying stuff that you really can't understand what he's saying. Like, apparently the chorus is, like Pilot, I have a dog. And for years, he somehow delivers the line, I have a dog, in a way that it almost sounded like he could be saying, I have radar, which would make more sense to flying an airplane. Not that the song itself is supposed to make sense. Jeff has said that the song was in relation to a question he'd been asking himself in response to a reoccurring dream he'd been having at the time about being old and sitting on a front porch with his dog. And so it's also a song that's written for dog lovers everywhere, because apparently everybody but me loves dogs more than anything else.
Why don't you love dogs?
Why don't you love breakfast?
Because breakfast food is not good. It's overrated.
Because a lot of dog owners are some of the most annoying people on the planet. I'm constantly yelling at people from my balcony that they need to pick up after their dogs, because they bring their dogs over to the little patch of grass in front of my apartment and don't pick up their shit. And we're talking about grown-ass people. We're not talking about, like, kids who are forced to take the dog out or the elderly. Okay, maybe my beef isn't with dogs. It's with dog people. I'll concede that point.
Okay.
It's evolution, baby.
Song 7, do the evolution.
This one they like playing.
They do. This has been played 548 times. And this song was put together by Eddie Vedder and Mr. Gossard on the music.
And this one is definitely another barn burner. It opens with some heavy riffing and heavy drums and Eddie howling like the madman he is. There's a nice bit around 110 where it just drops down to a solo guitar and Jack pounding the drums. And then Eddie and Jeff both re-enter and the band finds a way to go from starting with all that energy to keeping it up, but still managing to build it bigger. And at a point are even joined by a backing vocal chorus around 205.
More than any other track, this one really digs its teeth into the idea of the novel Ishmael that they were initially going for when they set out to make the album. And it was never released as a single, but still, it somehow managed to reach number 33 on the Billboard Modern Rock charts.
That was probably because this is the first time since their debut album 10 that the band made a music video. The video for Do the Evolution is an animated video that was directed by Kevin Altieri, who was a regular on Batman the Animated Series, and it was a joint effort with him and Todd McFarlane, who of course was the creator of Spawn. There's so much going on in that video and it covers so much ground, and I've always loved it. It's just such a video that's all over the place. But rewatching it a couple days ago for this review, it really left me the impression that somebody had animated a Diego Rivera mural.
The video was nominated for a Grammy for Best Short Form Music Video, but this also lost to Madonna for Ray of Light. The song was nominated for the Best Hard Rock Performance, but luckily they did not lose this one to Madonna. Oof. They lost to Jimmy Page and Robert Plant.
I think most people in a rock band can live with that.
I think so.
However, not so fun fact, Pearl Jam have been nominated for 12 Grammys and have only won as many as Homer Simpson. Or should I say the B-sharps?
Nice cut, Mark. Nice cut.
Which is to say that, like the B-sharps, Pearl Jam has only won one Grammy.
Yep. Those aren't good odds. 1 out of 12.
Now, I think one of my all-time favorite things about Pearl Jam as a band is intentionally misunderstanding what Eddie is saying. I know that their song Rats off of Verses is a great example of that, because it opens with "They don't eat, they don't sleep, lick the dirt off of larger ones' feet." But I always sing that as "lick the dirt off Elijah Wan's feet."
Reference to Hakeem Olajuwon, the center for the Houston Rockets back in the 90s.
Which is fitting because the band are big basketball fans. But just the way that he sings it, "don't eat, don't sleep, lick the dirt off Olajuwon's feet." It honestly sounds like he's saying Olajuwon.
I think it's gross no matter what they say.
There's a part in this song where early in the song he says, "I'm a head, I'm a man, I'm the first mammal to wear pants, yeah." And then later in the song they kind of echo and say, "I'm ahead, I'm advanced, I'm the first mammal to make plans, yeah." But I like to sing pants for both, and it kind of really sounds like he's saying pants in both spots anyway.
That's funny.
Do you have a favorite intentionally misheard Pearl Jam lyric?
Off of this album or in general?
Either.
Probably Better Man.
Okay, what part?
I thought back in the day, the line is, what, "she lies and says she's in love with him." I thought it was "she lies and says she's a lesbian." Anyway, yeah, Eddie Vedder's mumbling makes that really easy to do.
It's an iconic delivery.
It is.
That kind of started a trend. And I have to say, I think Christine's not giving you enough credit, because from the samples that you've given us today in your delivery, trying to sound like Pearl Jam, you don't make me think of Eddie Vedder. It makes me think that you're trying to sound like Scott Stapp.
Ew.
I'm sorry.
"She lies and says she's in love with him."
Yeah, there's more of like the warble to your voice that you're doing.
You're a warble.
Seems more like a "Take Me Higher."
You sing like "Take Me Higher."
But did you know
that— I don't care what you have to say. You just compared me to Scott Stapp.
Speaking of Better Man, did you know that it's actually a cover song?
Better Man is?
Yep.
Cover of who?
Eddie originally wrote Better Man with his prior band, Bad Radio, the one that had started off intentionally trying to sound like Duran Duran. There are videos on YouTube.
Huh.
And it's interesting, both how much the song really didn't change, and also the fact that he, you know, was able to wait 3 albums for the band to change their sound to then bring that one in.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm still offended.
As you should be.
You're hurtful. You make me sad. All right. I'm so upset I don't even have a segue for this ridiculously short next song, Untitled.
Untitled is track 8.
Your track 8.
Which, even with only 52 live performances, has been played way more times than the far superior song of No Way.
Did you know on Spotify it has a name, though?
What is it?
Red Bar.
Red Bar? Really?
Yep.
I know it is commonly referred to Red Dot because of, instead of writing out the word Untitled, it's frequently listed with just a red dot. However, on the Pearl Jam website, they do claim the title is Untitled.
Hmm. Okay. The booklet gives Jack credit for this one, which might be them being generous since it's a short, simple jam. But in all fairness to Jack, that jam is drum heavy and built around a tribal rhythm that he's playing, which intentionally picks up and loses steam as it goes. It's only 1 minute and 6 seconds, but it's a nice kind of intermission to listeners to catch their breath after Do the Evolution. And I think it's fun what he does with his voice.
Would you go so far as to say it's crazy?
It is crazy in such a good way.
Because as the vocals state, we're all crazy. And it just repeats that over and over.
It does. Before going to song number 9, MFC, which is written by Eddie Vedder and has been played 163 times.
This one starts off feeling a bit guitar noodly, but the guitars quickly come together and find a melody, and Eddie comes in before the drums, and it all ends up being a pretty solid Pearl Jam rock track. And this one gets my vote for the track on the album that sounds most like those classic first 2 albums era Pearl Jam. And thanks to the tone and quality and cadence of Eddie's vocals, it feels like it could be a sequel to their song off of Verses, Rearview Mirror, all one word, which kind of makes sense since in an Eddie Vedder kind of way, it is also a song about driving, or at least it was inspired by the chaotic traffic which he experienced in 1996 in Rome while on the tour for No Code, their prior album.
Hmm.
But an additional fun fact about that tour stop in Rome, while there, Eddie had found a book in a bookstore that was a copy of Pearl Jam songs translated to Italian. He bought the book, and while hanging out with some friends of theirs in Italy, he had them take a look at it and translate the words, and realized that the meanings of the songs, the way that they were translated, were far from what was intended. They all seemed a lot more negative and a lot more angry than he was, although he was plenty angry on those first couple albums. But when it came to doing the album art and the liner notes for this one, because of that, he decided to be a lot more deliberate in including lyrics in the album book. And so he's like, you know what? I don't want people to be confused about what I'm saying, because as we've mentioned, it's hard to understand what he's actually saying. So they made a more conscious effort on this album to include lyrics in the book because of that experience. So you could say that Eddie wanted people to understand his lyrics and not put them in a low light.
So we're 10 tracks in and we finally hit a soft Pearl Jam ballad. This is the only song on the album to be driven by acoustic guitars, and they almost make it a full 45 seconds before an electric guitar line comes in. There's even some organ playing that comes in a little later on the track, and rumor has it that producer Brendan O'Brien played that part.
Since Jeff wrote this one, we have a quote from him about it, and he says that this song is a follow-up to Pilot, which you loved.
That was my favorite song on the album.
And we mentioned earlier that that song was a question, and supposedly this one is the answer. Not that that really answers all of the questions I might now have from learning that about these songs, but according to him, it's about feeling, as he puts, grateful at finding that place of calm and peace at my center and getting a glimpse of the person I could choose to be. So I guess it's got a positive message to it.
I guess so.
Although in both songs, this one and Pilot, the way that he's talking about, it sounds like the meanings are in hiding.
Wow, so we're just jumping right over that to song 11, In Hiding.
Did you have anything else to say?
I had nothing to say about that song at all. I just like how you unceremoniously skipped everything else.
That's all we had on the notes.
In Hiding has been played 96 times since 1997.
And here they switch back to All Electric Business, but they keep the light, easy vibe of the prior track rather than going right back to full-on rock mode.
This is another blend with Vedder writing the words and Gossard doing the music. It's interesting to note, though, that it's a personal favorite off the album for both Irons and McCready, neither of whom were involved in the writing of the song.
I mentioned previously that they made the effort to put the lyrics in the booklet. However, on this one, instead of the song lyrics, it has a quote by Charles Bukowski, to which Eddie, explaining the origins of the track, said, "In Hiding is actually written about Bukowski. Sean Penn gave me a quote that Bukowski had said to him once, and it was written directly from that. He told Sean that sometimes he just has to check out for a few days. No people, no nothing. So he goes in hiding. Then he gets back and he has the will to live once again. Maybe because society takes you down. For all the good things we offer each other, sometimes we beat each other down." And that quote is presented in the booklet, and it reads, "4 days alone with nothing, emerge empowered. The first human face you see will knock you back 50%.
I was a fan of Bukowski. I did not know that had anything to do with this song, and I want to go back and listen to it again. There was no effort made to push this song as a single all on its own, but it still managed to chart. It hit number 13 on Billboard's Modern Rock Tracks and number 14 on the Mainstream Rock Track. And then it peaked at number 6 on Canada's Alternative Top 30 chart. Do you have thoughts or feelings about this song, Mark?
Not really. I think it does say something about the album as a whole, though, that you have multiple songs on here that are tracking, that are getting love, despite never being released as singles.
This song did resonate well with me.
Yeah, in a good way or a bad way?
In a good way. I liked it. He said, "I swallowed my words to keep from lying. I swallowed my face just to keep from biting. I swallowed my breath and went deep. I was diving. I was dying. I surfaced and all around me was enlightened. Now I'm in hiding." I don't know. I felt the feels with that. As opposed to some of the songs that push me, this one pulls me in.
Track 12, Push Me, Pull Me.
I'm not surprised to say that this song has only been played 14 times. I think when I did research and looked into this, for most people, this was in the very bottom of their ranking for this album.
So this one, just like the song No Way, was last played October 20th of 2014 in Milwaukee. As for whatever reason, on that night of the Lightning Bolt tour, Pearl Jam decided to play Yield start to finish in its entirety as part of a set that also included a special shout out to perennial runner-up Aaron Rodgers. That poor man could have been great if he didn't play football at the same time as Tom Brady.
Well, and if he didn't live in Brett Favre's shadow for a decade, you know, because Favre held on for way too long.
Anyway,
You know, like I said, I'm not surprised that this didn't get a lot of play. It never made it on the radio, and it's not getting play in their concert rotation. It's an experimental track for sure, but musically it still displays some solid rock chops while maintaining a fairly loose improvisational jam quality to all the parts. And Eddie's vocals are delivered spoken rather than sung.
Yeah, that delivery is an interesting shift in the vocal style that we're used to from Eddie Vedder.
I know, we can understand him.
Almost. It's a welcome change to his mumbled deliveries from All Those Yesterdays.
Song 13, All Those Yesterdays, was written by Gossard and has only been played 24 times since 1997.
The song initially starts off like it's going to close the album with Pearl Jam's own version of a lullaby. Has a light-picked, simple guitar melody that Eddie sings over fairly softly, but then the drum hits and Jeff enters with a funky, beefy bass line at around 1:30. There's even a horn part that comes in and sounds like a faint trumpet fart as it all picks up into kind of a shuffle. And on the whole, it's a ride that if you just sit back and decide you're going to go on, so you might as well enjoy it. It ends up being fairly fun. And looking back at it now, if I had realized it was all written by Stone, maybe I wouldn't have been so surprised by his first solo outing, because Bayleaf is an album that when it released, I eagerly picked up and quickly realized that it was not for me.
Anyway, All Those Yesterday ends. Then we have Silence and the awesome 90s bonus track for a song that is mostly guitar noodling and clapping and Eddie occasionally yelling that starts with him just singing huh, and as it progresses turns more into something that sounds more like hummus. And the reason it sounds like hummus, Mark, is because the song is called Hummus. I do want to take just a moment on this song and go to our sponsors at songmeanings.com.
Okay.
And I want to read what Ladybug had to say on April 29th, 2002.
About hummus or about All Those Yesterdays?
All Those Yesterdays.
Okay.
Says, man, this song reminds me of a friend of mine. That's all she said.
Good job.
But we can listen to April 25th, 2004, the day after I got married. Sober wrote, All Those Yesterdays talks about human beings and how they build walls around themselves by the lifestyle they choose and the situations they've been through. Who've been stupid for a couple of times, always believe that he is stupid. It's never too late to change. Forget what made you what you are and start changing yourself to something better. Let your mind relax. Move the walls of the thoughts you live in. Songmeanings.com, we're really scraping the barrel here. We need our check.
So that's it for the album Yield. This was an interesting point for the band. A lot of the reviews like to claim it was a Pearl Jam revival or a return to earlier rock sensibilities. And to an extent, that may be true. However, there are still a handful of tracks on here that are them much more artsy, which is something that they started with on Vitalogy, for better or for worse. But the way that I see it is that there are some of those earlier tones at play with the guitar work. But as a whole, it's a much more mature Pearl Jam sound. And more than that, I think it's the band taking who they've been, utilizing everything they've done previously, all of the influences up to that point, and using that established relationship with each other and really working out who they are beyond their grunge origins to figure out what the band Pearl Jam will be musically and how they exist as its own organism moving forward. Like we said, Vitalogy was kind of a big pivot for Pearl Jam, and it's where they started experimenting and the sound started shifting, and the No Code continued both the experimentation and the shift in sound. This kind of brings the tones back while keeping those elements, and to me, it's the best Pearl Jam album that they would make since Versus until Lightning Bolt.
Okay, then.
Which was a fantastic record on its own.
Lightning Bolt is a fantastic record all the way around.
Yeah. You had asked me during the process of us both researching this where I would place it in the Pearl Jam catalog.
Yep.
And at the point that it dropped, I would definitely place it at number 3. Once Lightning Bolt came out, I think maybe it's bumped it down a notch. But to me, it's still up there. There's definitely some flaws to the album, but the strong material is super strong. And there's more than just 3 top tracks on the album. Even the weaker tracks like Your Favorite Pilot, I don't think are as big of misses as other experimental tracks like their song Bugs from Vitalogy.
Oof, that was a low point.
And so I think when this came out, there had already been those kinds of swings and misses. So when I heard Pilot the first time, it wasn't such a shock to my system. But where would you place it?
Towards the bottom. I don't love it. I like Vitalogy more. I definitely like Lightning Bolt more. And of course, I really like 10 and In Utero.
In Utero is Nirvana.
Just checking to see if you're paying attention. I don't love this one. It's not something I'll just turn on and listen to.
As I've been doing this, I've taken a break from it to listen to the rest of the Pearl Jam catalog because I realized that there are a handful of albums that I had never really listened to before. And I don't think that Pearl Jam's ever made a consistently bad album. I think they've kind of hit a point where they've made consistently Pearl Jam sounding records that all have some good tracks and all have some that kind of seem middle of the road. But I think they've kind of, for the most part, on a lot of them, hit a comfort zone. And the reason that I would place Yield higher than most of them is because this does have some that swing way above that weight class. They haven't done anything since this, with the exception of some of the tracks in Lightning Bolt, that can compete with How Heavy, Brain of Jay, and Do the Evolution Hit, or just kind of groove as much as No Way. And so that's why, if we're placing it, I would still just place it up there under Lightning Bolt and over.
I don't know. It's just, it's a boring album. I don't feel connected to most of the songs. There are a couple I like. And I know Vitalogy is a pretty divisive album. A lot of people like it. A lot of people don't.
I never got into Vitalogy. Even the hits off of that, I don't know. They never did it for me. I mean, Nothing Man, just like the heaviest song on that. And it's still just middle of the road Pearl Jam rock to me. It's not really a heavy rock album.
I do like Vitalogy more. I think for me, it's probably the top is going to be somewhere between 10 and Lightning Bolt. Then I'd bring in Vitalogy, and I don't know a lot of the other stuff. So when I say the bottom, that's where I put, I forgot about Versus. Versus above Vitalogy.
So you're putting Yield at like fifth?
Yeah.
Okay. You've got like 6 to 8 other albums.
That we don't really know though, right?
Right.
I just kind of stopped listening.
That's what I'm saying. They hit a point after this where it's kind of like No Code. No Code's not terrible, but they just kind of figured out like an easy formula for them.
Right. I think I would consider this above No Code.
Okay, but I will disagree because I don't necessarily think that this is a boring album. Saying it's a boring album to me would imply that it doesn't really have any redeeming qualities.
When I say boring, like I'm not going to put it on and get excited and want to listen to it. I'm not going to want to play the whole thing. I'm going to lose interest and skip a bunch of songs or skip to a different album. Okay, instead of maybe saying boring, there's nothing here as a cohesive album to keep my attention to listen to the album.
Okay, the album as a whole doesn't flow, and I'll definitely say it's disjointed, but I still think that when this dropped, it contained a handful of songs that were some of the best songs that Pearl Jam had written since Versus. But speaking of individual tracks, top three.
You go, Mark. What are you thinking?
Number three, No Way. I love the way that song grooves.
Okay.
Number two was a tough one. It was kind of a toss-up between Brain of Jay and Do the Evolution, because both are bangers.
Yeah.
But I have to go with Do the Evolution because of the choir.
I do like that choir.
I love when they come in, all just harmonious, going, ooh. So good.
It was good.
And number one is Given to Fly. What do you got?
We are going to come in fairly close together. Number three as Faithful.
Okay.
I'm going to agree with you on number two, No Way, but you could not be more wrong with number one, which should be Pilot.
Ooh, another mislead. I like it.
No, I agree with you. Number one is Given to Fly. There's a reason that's their biggest hit from this album.
Yeah.
Which isn't always the case with hits.
I feel like with No Way not getting the love live that some of the other ones do, there was another interview that I had read, and I should have marked it or pulled the quotes. I don't remember who it was talking about. There's a handful of songs from their catalog that they don't play live because they don't feel that they've ever been able to replicate how well it jams on an album. And I think No Way is in that group. And it is them jamming in a way that does feel very classic Pearl Jam rock.
Yep, agreed.
And that is Pearl Jam's Yield. Hit us up on Instagram or find our website and leave us a comment. Let us know what you think, what your favorite tracks from the album are, where Yield falls in Pearl Jam's catalog. Or feel free to chime in on the debate if Tom singing sounds like Eddie Vedder or more like Scott Stapp.
Mark, stop it.
Until next time, thanks for listening. This has been another episode of Once Every 2 Weeks.
Bye.
Once Every 2 Weeks is sponsored by Bro Baracho Records.